Fasten your seatbelts and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip. History books refer to the United States as the melting pot where all nations and traditions blend together. Indeed, our holiday celebrations in North Central Wisconsin would indicate just that, whether you celebrate Christmas, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, or another winter holiday. But where and when did our traditions begin?
At Christmas time, we raise our hearts and celebrate the solstice. At Christmas time, we raise our hearts and celebrate the solstice. At Christmas time.
Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seewert. The ways we celebrate year after year differ based on our religious beliefs, our family traditions, and even our personal ancestry. From singing songs and reciting poems, to decorating trees and swapping cookies, to guzzling eggnog and wearing ugly sweaters, there's a story behind every tradition, many of which can be traced back centuries. Today, we take a look at the stories behind our traditions with the help of two guests. From the Marathon County Historical Society, Ben Clark is here today. Ben, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Also joining us today is Dr. James Leary, Emeritus Professor of Folklore and Scandinavian Studies from the University of Wisconsin. Dr. Leary, thank you so much for joining us.
Happy to be here.
You can join the conversation, too, by calling 800-780-9742 or emailing us at route51@wpr.org. Callers, please allow plenty of time for our producer to answer your call. I love the Christmas season. I look forward to it every year. It's my favorite time of year. And my own holiday traditions are very much the same as those from my childhood. Jim, how much are our traditions a product of our upbringing? I mean, do we tend to always adopt the experiences of our parents and grandparents? Do we pass those down?
Well, people have a lot of choice, I think, in what they want to do. And people are often not isolated later on. My wife, for example, is part Norwegian, and so there are certain food traditions that I didn't grow up with, at least not in my family, although I grew up in Rice Lake with plenty of Norwegians around there. So I was familiar with some of the Romagrot, Lutefisk, some of those kinds of foods, and the julebok, the straw goat as a decoration. But that didn't enter into the household until I got hooked up. And so there are different combinations that do happen. Sometimes people revive old traditions. Sometimes they reject traditions. Sometimes they merge traditions. Sometimes they continue traditions.
Sure. And do you really eat the lutefisk?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I have some Norwegian in me too, and that's just one thing I cannot go there.
Sparingly, you know, I have been at lutefisk dinners where there are people who are just making the circuit, and that's all they eat, wearing their doll sweaters. They scrape mass quantities. I have a little bit, and then I eat more of the meatballs. So,
all right. Well, all right. I can understand that. So, Ben, when we're talking about Marathon County and our region, I mean, what kind of ancestral heritage do we see the most here? There's a lot of German. There's Scandinavian.
Yeah.
What else? Well, what else?
Yeah, it is. It is one of those situations where, you know, depending on what time you're looking at, you have different groups of people that are moving here. By and large, here in Marathon County, which is the area that I'm more familiar with, certainly it's a very German population, and specifically Central Wisconsin is very German. You know, but depending on, you know, just to get to the traditions here, you might have very different traditions if you come from Bavaria in the south versus the Pomeranians in the north. And so depending on where you are, even with Marathon County, different areas have different things that they bring into their, you know, traditions as well. But then there are also, you know, pockets of Polish and Irish and Czech, and, you know, we have pretty good representation. But yeah, we are mostly German here, I would say.
All right. Well, let's talk about some of the most common traditions. I mean, whether we live in Wisconsin or not, the Christmas tree is, of course, one of the most recognizable symbols of the holiday. And last year's American Christmas Tree Association survey showed 77% of U.S. households put up a tree last year. So I guess, where did the tree tradition come from? Jim, do you know?
Yeah, it really came from northern regions. Of course, it's common in Scandinavia, historically with lit candles, but it's also very strongly German. And in the United States, of course, German immigrants sustained this tradition, but it didn't really become part of American popular culture until the mid-19th century. And it was partly WASPy people who always are kowtowing to British royalty and so forth, noticing that Queen Victoria's husband, Prince Albert, who is German, you know, set up the Christmas tree. And then pretty soon the daughters of the American Revolution or what have you were having Christmas tree parties in the 19th century. And it kind of took over the way that, you know, pizza spread wildly as a food tradition. So some of these things that we think of as old American traditions, often thinking in a kind of a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant or British Isle sort of sense, really weren't that at all. The Christmas tree was a kind of a fad that took hold in nationwide in the 19th century by people looking toward England.
Ben, I have to say that here in North Central Wisconsin, it's a big tradition to go out and cut down your tree or get a fresh tree. But when I talk to friends in other areas of the country, they can't even imagine that. I mean, it's artificial trees everywhere. I mean, how big is the tree industry here for Christmas trees?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, today it's definitely a big area. You have tree farms all over the place, and it has something that. You know, we have been a source in central Wisconsin. You know, obviously the lumber industry is kind of what makes much of Wisconsin up here. And so the tradition, you know, obviously Christmas trees are a little smaller than the big white pines that they're cutting down, you know, in the 1840s and 50s. But certainly that tradition of harvesting trees, you know, we have this wealth of forests and things like that. So we are kind of fortunate in that. You know, the ancestors here and that sort of tradition was established that you could just go out and get your own tree. Whereas obviously that's not as common in other places. Yeah.
I've been reading too, that more folks are going out to cut their trees now as a family since COVID. It's an outside thing that they can do, a way for families to do something important together. So that's an interesting trend as well.
If I could just add something about this, nowadays it seems like it's increasingly common for people to set up their Christmas tree right after Thanksgiving or soon after. And some people even throw it out a day or two after Christmas. But there are older traditions, and I know these have been strong among Germans that I've done field work with in Wisconsin, where people used to get the Christmas tree on Christmas Eve or very close to that, and then it would be decorated that night. And then the season begins, and it extends at least through the Epiphany or Three Kings Day. And so there are these older kinds of traditions that some people keep up. When my kids were young, they're all out of the house now, but we would typically wait until quite late to get our tree, and we'd go out and cut it, and then we would keep it up longer.
My dad did that too. I mean, he didn't put the Christmas tree up on Christmas Eve by any means, but he did keep it up longer than the others. It always startles me to see the day after Christmas these trees out on the curb. But I mean, when did that change? Is that a relatively recent thing?
I think so. I'm 70 years old, and you know, I guess I've noticed it over the last 20, 25 years. Now, you can see it in some areas. People are fishing on the ice, and it's a nice way to, you know, to mark the ice road or something.
Sure.
By putting the trees on the side. But other than that, I think, wow, it's getting rid of it pretty quick.
Well, I want to talk about parades a little bit. So many of our local communities here host holiday parades. They're often the biggest parades of the year. I mean, 150 to 200 floats and the streets are absolutely filled with people. Of course, it's going to look a little different this year. In fact, Wausau's is tonight, and they're having people drive by the floats instead of the floats driving by the people. So, of course, that's different. But Ben, what started the Christmas parade tradition?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because the Wausau tradition, you mentioned the parade here, that actually goes back to 1929, which is kind of an interesting origin because the local business leaders decided it would be maybe good for business to have Santa visit. And so they actually had, I'm not sure they changed over the years, but in this particular year, they actually, like, the newspapers actually followed him from city to city. They must have had had one route that they were following. And so they said, oh, well, he's coming. He's over here in this new city and he's coming here. And, you know, he brought his reindeer and it was a big deal. It's like this is before you could go to the department store or the mall and get your picture taken with Santa. This was, you know, kind of at the beginning of this. And so he came and it was, you know, they had a little parade for him. In later years, they did things like, this initial one was just, he came and went pretty quickly, but they ended up having things where, well, they built a little ice house for him, like an igloo that they actually had lit up with lights as this big, like luminous building that they built on the courthouse grounds to house him. Cause obviously Santa is used to the cold weather. He can't be in a hotel where it's warm. He has to be out in the cold. So they would do things like that. And then the other thing that happened was they started to bring him in by airplane. In part because I think that they didn't want it, that first year they had some issues with the supposed reindeer, which are probably just some sort of deer, that didn't necessarily make it the whole trip. And so they said, well, he left his reindeer at a barn outside of town. And then they started actually just bringing him in by airplane because we had the Alexander Airport was built. And so that was another way to, you know, people would go to the airport to see him come in. And that was kind of the genesis of that. I mean, obviously, it has shifted. It's not so much about Santa. It's about the community these days. But that's kind of where the origin of that comes from.
We'll talk about St. Nicholas Day just a little later on. But how about Santa Claus bringing toys to children on Christmas? Where did that originate, Jim?
Oh, well, you know, again, it's kind of a mixed phenomenon. That there are plenty of German elements, but you know, in different cultures, there are different figures who bring gifts, and oftentimes the gift giving in America has taken on this commercial impetus that Ben talked about in relation to the parade. A lot of the older traditions, if one goes back into the 19th century, had to do with house visiting and kind of singing or putting on, you know, disguises and demanding food and drink from your neighbors or some kind of wealthy person. And then there's been a shift from people kind of exchanging on that kind of local food and drink level to people, you know, going to the mall or stores.
Yes.
Or forking
out.
It's
amazing how it's changed, right?
Yeah.
Yes. You're listening to Dr. Jim Leary and Ben Clark, a discussion on the history of holiday traditions and what sets us apart in North Central Wisconsin. You can join the conversation too by calling 800-780-9742 or email questions and comments to Route51@WPR.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Oh, the weather outside is frightful, but the fire is so delightful. Since we've no place to go, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow. It doesn't show signs of stopping, and I brought some corn for popping. The lights are turned down low.
Just hear those sleigh bells jingling, ring, ting, tingling too. Come on, it's lovely weather for a sleigh ride together with you. Outside the snow is falling and friends are calling you. Come on, it's lovely weather for a sleigh ride together with you.
We're back on Route 51. I'm Shireen Seewert. Dr. Jim Leary, Emeritus Professor of Folklore and Scandinavian Studies from the University of Wisconsin, and Ben Clark from the Marathon County Historical Society are here today talking about the origins of our holiday traditions in north central Wisconsin. We'll take your questions, too. Call us at 800-780-9742. When calling, please allow enough time for our producer to answer your call, or email us at route51@wpr.org. Ben, one of the things I remember doing with my kids when they were younger, now they're all older and moved away, but at the elementary schools in Wausau, many of them, John Marshall, for example, they have a day just before the holiday break when parents are invited to the school to help their kindergartner build a gingerbread house. This was like a really big deal for the kids. But why a gingerbread house? I mean, what's the deal with that?
Yeah. I'm trying to remember this. Maybe Jim would probably speak to the origins of this. I know it was popularized by the Brothers Grimm, the Hansel and Gretel story. That's kind of where it comes from. But I think a lot of traditions, they kind of, as they make their way to the new area, new experiences, you kind of, it turns it into something a little different. But I don't know, Jim, do you want to talk about?
Well, I think gingerbread, there's a strong kind of German connection with a lot of that too. And Pfeffernuss is of course a cookie that kind of has that gingerbready quality that Germans often make it at Christmas time. Maybe the last 40 or 50 years, gingerbread houses and house making have kind of gone beyond the sort of German connection to become more widespread. And of course it's kind of an exciting thing for kids to imagine this house made out of all sorts of sweets. But as you say, Ben, there's that clear Hansel and Gretel connection.
Sure. St. Nicholas Day is coming up. It's Sunday this year. When my father was alive, we always celebrated this, St. Nicholas Day. And I still remember the time when I was a young kid, I went to school the next day after I got my little gifts on St. Nicholas Day. And I was completely flabbergasted that none of my friends had any idea what I was talking about. They were like, what is St. Nicholas Day? And I felt like I felt like we were doing something different. But what is St. Nicholas Day? How can you explain it? And how did it start, Dr. Leary?
Well, St. Nicholas was a fourth century bishop who was, according to legend, revered for his generosity to some young people who were without. And the St. Nicholas Day tradition is really strongest in Europe, in Germanic areas, Germany and the Netherlands, or parts of what became Germany. And it involves putting out your shoe or your shoes or your stockings the night of, if you're a kid, December 5th, and then the next, during the night, St. Nicholas comes, and the next day you've got something. And when I'm Irish American in my background, but I grew up in Rice Lake, and I went to a Catholic school, and that's in the Diocese of Superior. The controlling priests were all Germans, the bishops and the monsignors and the main priests, and like the lesser priests seemed like they were Irish or Italian or Polish. And at my Catholic school, St. Nicholas Day involved a local guy dressing up as St. Nicholas. And I remember there was the Polish priest, Father Peter Szlezinski, who was Black Peter, the sidekick. And they would, we'd assemble in the school gymnasium, and everybody would get a bag of hard candy, unless supposedly you had been a bad person. And then you would get a bag with some coal in it or something like that. I don't know if anybody ever did, but it was rumored that some people did. But this was a kind of an example of, we have what folklorists and cultural anthropologists call great traditions that you know, are associated with the people. And then there are little traditions which actually happen more in the home. And then there are kind of commercial or organizational appropriations of traditions to serve, you know, their organizations, economic other kind of mission. And so you have these kinds of interesting mixtures all going on. And clearly at the Catholic school I went to, there were enough Germans involved in the hierarchy that they thought St. Nicholas, you know, must happen, even though a lot of us were Irish or French Canadian or, you know, of other Italian, as well as Germans and Poles and Czechs at the school that I went to.
Sure. What about the pickle ornament? This is something I never heard of until maybe, I think, 10 years ago. Hide the green pickle on the tree. The first child to find it gets to open the first present. And I've heard different stories about how this originated. Ben, did you ever put a pickle on your Christmas tree?
I can't say that I ever did. And I'm honestly not entirely sure. That's new. That's a new one to me, actually.
Well, there. So, now you need a pickle for your tree this time. Jim, what about the pickle? Do you know anything about the pickle?
Well, there is. It's German in some kind of way, but I don't know a lot of details. When I taught at University of Wisconsin, I used to teach a course called Folklore of Wisconsin, and we looked at all sorts of different things, and students had to do field research papers, and sometimes students would do them about holiday or seasonal traditions. And I knew I had several students from over around Sheboygan and some of those German areas extending from Milwaukee up toward Manitowoc. And you know, they were familiar with that pickle tradition. It was new to me, but there are these traditions sometimes with New Year, for example, be a pudding and it has one almond in it or something like that. And whoever gets the almond has luck. And there are these kinds of holiday traditions involving hiding something and identifying something and the delight that especially children can get out of that if they do make the discovery.
Sure. You know, we talked about parades earlier and how prevalent they are here in North Central Wisconsin. Ben, what other unique civic celebrations do we see in this area? I mean, winter wonderlands and cookie fairs, and what are the kinds of things that we see that you might not see in Florida or Texas, for example?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of. I mean, there's interesting like idiosyncrasies that certainly come up in terms of the way that we celebrate certain things.
Sure.
You know, nothing. Trying to think of what specifics are. Like, I don't know that I have a specific. I think one of the interesting things is, you know, you see all of these groups of people that come together. You know, you have the pickle tradition or the, you know, there is sort of an Americanization, which is kind of, you know, certainly in the 20th century. And we touched on this a little bit earlier about how, you know, all these little traditions. One of the interesting things is that, you know, ultimately, a lot of this, the development of this doesn't necessarily happen. You know, the big traditions, the Christmas traditions, you can see them happening in local, like for example, letters to Santa is an example. Like that's something that, you know, it didn't start here, but people were doing it here. You know, that's something that, a little bit about that, like when that first started, the post office wasn't exactly set up to deliver letters to the North Pole because, you know, it's not really a valid postal address. So, you know, ultimately we do have other organizations that come into being to accept those letters. But, you know, here in Central Wisconsin, you know, for example, the Wausau Daily Herald said, hey, kids, if you're having, you know, worried about whether or not Santa's going to get your letter, well, he gets the Daily Herald delivered every day. So if you send the letters to us, well, we'll print them in the Daily Herald, and then you can be sure that Santa will get the letter. So that's like an example there of, you know, it didn't last very long because it ended up becoming so popular that they were running out of room. Like they'd have to do like full sheets of paper every couple of days of just all of these letters. So by the 30s, they transitioned into printing just the names of the people, which wasn't as fun you know, to have mm-hmm. your name sent in. But that's an example of like, you know, here's a wider tradition that everybody's doing. We're kind of developing it as a culture. And you can see it kind of pop up in local places.
From a historical perspective, winter has always been a time for gatherings. Among the Ojibwe and Chippewa and in northern Wisconsin lumber camps, there were various storytelling and entertainment traditions. So, Jim, can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, you know, when, of course, there were indigenous people here, and then there were newcomers from various places, and to some extent they kept to themselves or settled in their little enclaves, but there were definitely work instances where people from a lot of diverse backgrounds got together. And of course, one had to do with the old lumber camps where you couldn't really move the timber until the ground was frozen. And so you went into the woods in the wintertime, and people were there for a sustained period, and people from all sorts of backgrounds. And it was pretty much men, young men to older men. And on a Saturday night, they would entertain themselves. And if one looks at Irish, for example, they had the tradition of the Ceilidh, which typically happened in the winter in agrarian areas where, you know, your harvest was over, planting and all, planting and harvesting and tending. And so you had more leisure time. You also had stored up food from, you know, whatever you harvested. So that was a time for sociability. And there was an expectation that everyone had to contribute to the entertainment. It was an old house party tradition. So you had to be able to sing a song or do a trick or tell a joke or dance a dance or, you know, something like that. And French Canadian people had something called the VA, which refers to evening. And you'd spend an evening together, which was pretty much the same thing. For Ojibwes and a lot of Native people, Algonquian Native people, winter was a time when you could tell traditional stories. And there were a couple of reasons for that. You know, one was you were kind of confined for a long time, and that sure. that helped pass the time. But the stories were also ways of educating younger people. Elders would tell stories, but stories could also be told because they had to do with the you know, the animal people, and it wasn't polite to talk about them when they were around a lot, but they'd either migrated or they were hibernating, and so you could, you know, mm-hmm. you could talk about them without being overheard,
sure.
so to speak. And so when you had, you know, Native peoples as well as, you know, Irish, French, Canadians, and then Norwegians had a strong tradition that we could talk about in some detail of julebukking. It was a house visiting masquerading tradition that would happen the day after Christmas for a couple of weeks, and people would dress in disguise and barge into neighbors' homes. And Polish people had something too, where so-called gwajki, it means star in Polish, but star boys, and it was usually young adolescents. And if one nowadays searches in historic newspapers like the Stevens Point Daily Journal, using the term Christmas fools or Christmas fooling, that was kind of the English term, you can find instances of Norwegians and Poles, usually adolescents, kind of rowdy adolescents, roaming around the countryside in disguise, and they'll barge into someone's home or show up at their home. They might sing some songs and they'll ask for food and drink. And usually they would get other people to kind of go along with them. And if they planned well, they'd end up at the home of someone who is a musician, you know, a concertina player or a fiddler.
Right.
And then you'd kind of whoop it up through the night. And so you had events like that happening.
Ben is a musician, so I think he can relate to that, right? Okay. Sure, yeah. You know, there are a number of non-Christian celebrations that happen during the holiday season. I'd like to touch on those. The Jewish community, for example, celebrates Hanukkah. And some of us tend to think of Hanukkah as like the Jewish Christmas. But Ben, what are your thoughts on that? Is Hanukkah really as important as Christmas is to Christians? Or
I would say it seems to be the case that you know, I've heard some of my Jewish friends explain it like, you know, Hanukkah is almost more important to non-Jewish people than it is to Jewish people. It's certainly a holiday. It's certainly something that they celebrate, but it's not as big of a deal. It's not a high holiday. So it's not, when it comes to the Jewish calendar, it's something that, you know, they celebrate it. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's because of that reason. And I should say, you know, more recently it's become a bigger deal. It's you know, maybe becoming more of a important part of the tradition, maybe to some families. But historically, it's not necessarily something that is, you know, whereas Christmas traditions have kind of bled into the popular celebration, you know, you have decorations in Main Street and things like that. You don't generally see, you know, a giant dreidel or a menorah on the city hall, you know,
sure,
or something like that.
Sure.
It's going to be kind of like but it would be sort of like a, you know, something that they would do as a family or as maybe a potluck or something, a dinner at the temple. But it wouldn't be like a big deal that they would necessarily traditionally do it.
That's interesting. The Hmong New Year, also celebrated around this time every year. We have a strong, vibrant Hmong community in this area. Jim, what's that celebration like? Do you know much about the Hmong New Year celebration?
Yes. Well, I wouldn't say I know a lot, but I know a little from having spent some wonderful time with various Hmong people. Not so much in Wausau, but in Eau Claire, Menominee, Sheboygan, Madison area. And typically, New Year, you know, which is the old lunar calendar New Year, happening sometime later on in January, would be a time when you would get a new outfit and people would gather together. And then it was also a time for tossing. There are these Hmong songs called Gutsia, Hmong folk songs, and some of them are courtship songs. And at New Year's, young men and women, unmarried, would get together and toss a ball back and forth. While they were doing this, it was kind of a singing game. They would sing these gutsia, these kind of courtship songs in Hmong. And for Hmong nowadays in Wisconsin, New Year's has become almost like a large family reunion, and it's sort of for the community, but it's also open to the public, kind of like, you know, when a given group has an ethnic festival, the Polka Panacea or something, and in Stevens Point, as a fundraiser, or a church dinner focusing on, you know, I grew up with Czechs or Bohemians, and they would have Eternici and Roliki and these potato dumplings, Nedliki, called Bohemian sinkers, and, you know, before the local community, but they would invite Irish people like me. Hmong have made this into a kind of a public festival, and it's very much part of a winter seasonal scene in Wisconsin in the 21st century.
You're listening to Dr. James Leary and Ben Clark, a discussion on the history of holiday traditions and what sets us apart in North Central Wisconsin. You can join the conversation, too, by calling 800-780-9742 or email questions and comments to Route51@WPR.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
A beautiful sight, happy tonight, walking in a winter wonderland.
Gone away is the bluebird, here to stay is a new bird. He sings a love song as we go along,
walking in a winter wonderland. Chestnuts roasting on an open fire, Jack Frost nipping at your nose, Yuletide carols being sung by a choir, and folks dressed up like Eskimos.
We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seewert. Dr. Jim Leary, Emeritus Professor of Folklore and Scandinavian Studies from the University of Wisconsin, and Ben Clark from the Marathon County Historical Society are here today talking about the origins of our holiday traditions and the ways they're unique to us in north central Wisconsin. We'll gladly take your questions, too. The number to call is 800-780-9742. When calling, please allow enough time for our producer to answer your call. Or email us at route51@wpr.org. The winter solstice, December 21st. What is the spiritual significance of the winter solstice, Jim?
Well, a lot of our deep traditions are based on earlier pre-Christian patterns, and they have to do with the turning of the year. There are times when certainly the days grow longer and or shorter in terms of light, and so it stands at the opposite end to midsummer in June, where the light is at the most. And people have historically have looked at this as a time of death and revival of darkness and light. And so, you know, if you think it's kind of a dramatization of the seasons, leaves are turning, the ground freezes, it's dark. And so there's a kind of a life cycle to the season that's happening. And then after that point, the light begins to increase and you start moving towards spring, and there are different ways to dramatize and celebrate all of that or ritualize it. So fundamentally, the solstice is this marking of a significant turn of the year. Other things happen in terms of old belief systems at the turn of the year. And one thing is this is supposedly a time when the divisions between the sort of normal or natural world and the supernatural world can break down or open up. And say for the listeners of Norwegian heritage, there are these old traditions of the Undrejordiska, the Huldur, the underground people, or the hidden people. And they can roam around more. They can cross over during those times in the same way that Halloween is one of those turns. And there are these old Irish traditions that the fairy folk can also cross over. And that's partly why you disguise yourself so mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. you can't be identified quite so easily by them, but it's also in some ways a playful way of dramatizing the presence of these otherworldly spirits by just disguising oneself, and that can happen around solstice time too. Sure. in various traditions.
Can we talk about food for a little bit? I mean, Christmas is all about food for my family. I mean, we're planning dinner when we're eating lunch. That's kind of how we are. But what are some of the most iconic holiday food traditions in north central Wisconsin that you can think of, Ben? I mean, I can tell you one for sure is Wildcat. I mean, people in the South think that's the weirdest thing ever. And some people call them cannibal sandwiches, and I know the health department hates that, but I love it. Is that just a Wisconsin thing?
Well, so I'm going to be honest here. I have a lot of food allergies. So growing up, I'm not a very adventurous eater. So when it comes to cuisine, I'm really not the best person to ask about that. So I've again, that's a new one to me. I've never heard of Wildcat before, so I couldn't tell you.
Oh, you must try it. I mean, and then there's the fruitcake, right? I mean,
sure.
Johnny Carson once joked that the fruitcake is the worst Christmas gift ever. He said, there's only one fruitcake in the entire world and people keep sending it to each other. Jim, a lot of people love fruitcake during the holidays. Here, of course, the German Stollen is also very, very popular. But why is fruitcake a holiday thing?
Well, that's more of a British thing, and I don't like it all that much either, unless it's heavily soaked in brandy. and it's okay with me, but I'm more partial to Norwegian stuff, Krumkaka, Berliner Kranz, Fatigman, rosettes.
Yes.
They're all these cookies that fundamentally they're milk, eggs, flour, and sugar, but sometimes you put a little almond flavoring in them, or sometimes you you put them in a little pan with fluted edges, or you fry them with some sort of pattern, or so you have different ways of making something that's simple but also festive, because it has a different shape and technique, and maybe a hint of cardamom or almond or something
sure.
like that in it. And that's the kind of stuff that I enjoy the most.
Yeah, we had rosettes when I was a kid, and sunbuckles.
Those
were just fantastic. But and never any other time of the year. It was always during the holidays. Jim, I want to bring you back to, we were talking about the Christmas tree tradition and how it used to be the tradition to put the Christmas tree up on Christmas Eve, and that's when the holiday really began. And that made me think of the 12 Days of Christmas, the song about gifts from a true love. Everybody knows that song. But what exactly are the 12 Days of Christmas? And what's the significance of that and the 12th night?
Oh, man. I can't quite remember. The song is English. It's an English song. And, of course, Shakespeare has a play, Twelfth Night. And I think that's around the Epiphany. I guess I'd have to count from Christmas, but it's about 12 days. And a part of it is the idea that Christmas isn't just the one day. It's a season. We use that term, and officially, Christmas Eve or Christmas Day to January 6th, the Epiphany is kind of the quasi official season, and the song invokes that.
Sure. And Ben, as a musician, I'm sure you played that song a million times.
Popular one, for sure.
Yeah, for sure. I am curious about some other traditions, too. The Yule log, that's a big symbol of Christmas. How did the crackling fireplace get to be synonymous with Christmas? And frankly, how is Santa supposed to get down the chimney if you've got a Yule log going?
That's another one. I'd have to look it up, because
oh yeah,
one always hears about the Yule log, but we never did a damn thing with one.
Sure,
but you have a fire because it's cold, and years ago I remember talking to some old Polish folks in Portage County, and they used to heat up a poker in the fire, and they would make some kind of a hot drink. Grog, they'd stick the poker into some kind of vessel to warm up their drink, which is getting us back to food and drink, hot toddies, Tom and Jerry's, Glug, this kind of mold,
yep.
mold wine, which is really
wassail. Really what is wassail anyway?
it's a kind of an ale, and that's an English sort of thing, and there are a lot of wassailing songs. They're fundamentally begging songs. You know, you come and wish health. You know, they come from old peasant traditions where, you know, the ruling classes had their mostly exploited peasants working on their land, and they'd get paid pittances and have little places to live. But at Christmas, they could come en masse and sing songs and demand food and drink from the lords.
I'm wondering, did that wassail tradition then kind of morph into the Christmas carols, singing Christmas carols? Ben, when you were a kid, I don't know about you, but I did this when I was a kid, but did you ever go door to door with a group and sing Christmas carols to random neighborhood strangers?
I did not. I come from a musical family, but we're more instrumental, so we don't do a whole lot of singing necessarily, but so we definitely have played a lot of, you know, Christmas church venues, things like that over the years. But certainly, you know, yeah, I don't know. I don't know that I've seen too much of it myself, but I know it's definitely a thing.
Okay. Hey, Chris from Adams called. She had to had a bad cell connection, but she wanted to let us know that the cannibal sandwich, the wildcat, comes from France. So apparently it's not just a strange Wisconsin thing that I enjoy. So there we have it. What do you know about the reasons we send Christmas cards? Where did that tradition come from? Jim, do you know?
No.
Ben, any idea? I mean, I always wonder where these things, you know, where these things come from.
Yeah, well, there was, you know, in the 1800s, when you started to see the creation of like print culture, where people leave like their calling cards, and you know, you'd visit somebody and you leave a little souvenir or say, you know, call me back, or you know, that sort of thing. I imagine it kind of comes from that development of you know, hey, we can get these nice prints. You know, similar thing like postcards, for example, at the beginning of the 20th century become very popular, and you start immediately to see novelty postcards that are, you know, Christmas themed or New Year's themed and things like that. It's just a, you know, and I'm not sure about the specifics if there's a deeper story behind that, but I would imagine at, you know, the turn of the century, you start to see the ability to actually, you know, go and buy something that is pre-made, and I'm sure that tremendously helped the ability to the popularization of the Christmas card.
Well, before we wrap up today, I want to ask you both, I'd love to know your own favorite holiday traditions. Ben, what is your favorite thing about the holiday season? When you think holidays, what do you look forward to the most?
Well, I mean, it's probably a boring answer, but it's, you know, it's getting to see family and getting together with, you know, one of the few times, I mean, maybe not this year in 2020 because of the way things are, but, you know, getting together with, you know, your family, your cousins and aunts and uncles and, you know, getting to see and catch up the last year that you don't necessarily keep in touch as much. So I think for me, that's definitely a big part of our tradition going and, you know, seeing the whole family getting all together in one place. Again, maybe not this year for the best idea, but you know, hopefully soon.
You can always do it via Zoom, though.
Yeah. Yes.
Jim, what about you? What's nearest and dearest to you when it comes to the holiday celebrations?
I've become really fond of my wife's Norwegian traditions. On Christmas Eve, she makes a salmon and potato and cream kind of a casserole, and then she makes romagrøt, this cream pudding, and this wonderful sweet bread called julekake. And then in the morning, we have the leftover sweet cream soup and the julekake with a tangerine and open the presents.
Nice.
And I really enjoy making that. I've even learned to make it myself when her dad was dying and she had to go out at Christmas time to Oregon, and I was home with the kids. I made all that stuff, but myself. So
sure, I mean those traditional food things sometimes are really they really make the season. So and family, of course. That's all we have time for today on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. I'd like to thank our guests, Dr. James Leary and Ben Clark. Our executive producer and on-air producer today is Rick Ryer. Our producer is Joy Rotch-Kramer. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Special music today from Dan Fogelberg, Frank Sinatra, Ella Fitzgerald, Lady Gaga, and Tony Bennett, and Andrew Peterson. You can hear the archive of today's program at WPR.org/Route 51. Next week, Rick Ryer will be your host with a conversation about Star Wars, Star Trek, and the Iola author who writes many of their stories. If you have questions for a guest or an idea for a future program, email us at Route51 at WPR.org. Until next week, we're heading out of town.